The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, it's good to be here. So, today is March 20th. This is the equinox, right? So, we have equal amounts of black and white, night and day. Kind of a central point. It's a place of equilibrium. So tonight I'm inspired to talk about equanimity, but not just any kind of equanimity. I'm particularly interested in meeting passion with equanimity. For me, I'm interested in equanimity as a source of strength, right? Strength and wisdom, not that knife edge either or balance point. That's too narrow for me and not a position of strength to be sitting on that edge. What I want to talk about is the equanimity that allows us to stay in a broader place, that allows us to sustain the winds that come toward us without being blown away, or that come from inside us without being blown away. I want to talk about that ragged place, you know, the ragged place where we can't quite find our way and we find ourselves getting really agitated, really irritated, really excited, losing it, right? This is what I want to talk about tonight. And I want to talk about equanimity that becomes a support for us, a place of resting, that kind of equanimity, the place of rest. This topic actually came to me a few weeks ago because I was becoming quite despondent about conversations with my friends. I'm sure it has not escaped your attention that this is a presidential election year. And what this brings up is a lot of intense conversation, not all of it pleasant, right? I mean, I have most of my friends will ask, who are you voting for? And then they proceed to spend the next 2 hours convincing me I should be voting for their person, right? Now, there are all kinds of ways that we can react to this sort of stimulus. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. But I had friends over for dinner, and they started in where they wanted to talk about the presidential election. And I said, you know, I'd like us not to talk about that tonight. And they were in shock. How could you possibly not want to talk about this? And it actually was pretty acute because the woman partner, the guest that came over, is a new citizen of the United States, and this is her first presidential election, and she was geared for this. This is what she was going to talk about. And I realized I just didn't want to go through that intensity around something where nobody in the room was going to convince anybody else of their point of view. You either agreed or you disagreed. And it was sitting on that knife edge of either or, and I just didn't want to do that. So then the other thing I did is I went to a lecture on nuclear proliferation. That was the concern being that there's more interest in nuclear power now as a result of the rising energy prices. And so I thought, well, this will be an interesting topic. And the opening speaker went for a laugh by denigrating one of the presidential candidates. And it was effective. You know, it was a cheap shot. It was easy to do. He got his laugh. And I quit listening. Actually, I didn't quit listening because I did go with the interest in the topic. But I changed my ear so that I was listening with a great deal of suspicion because this person was more interested in setting up the good guys and the bad guys than in really talking about an issue that has great import. You know, it was more about us and them. So I thought, okay, I'm clearly having a problem here with maintaining my own equanimity in the face of a lot of people who have really strongly held opinions. So what do I do about that? So some of these exchanges led me to feel like my blood pressure was rising. I wasn't really in control. I was getting energized, and I was ready to go do battle. And then I'd say, I don't want to feel this way. Look, here I've got my fists are tight, my shoulders are high. I don't like this contraction, right? I found myself doing that, and I didn't want to do that. Now, it doesn't have to be a political issue. It can be any controversial issue. It can be a child coming home from school and being harassed by someone. It can be losing someone that is dear to us. Anything that really hits us in our sense of justice, our sense of security, our sense of self, those are the things that really get us riled and have a tendency to sort of blow us off course. Our practice, on the other hand, is about the end of suffering. It isn't so much about maintaining a position as it is about stopping suffering. And how do we do that? Somewhere in this place where we feel like we're being battered is a place where we can practice getting rid of that battering feeling. Can we find the balance to interact in a way that doesn't leave us with that contracted feeling? One of the things that I became aware of was that every time I read one of the political columns about the presidential election, there'd be all this blogging that came after it, right? And the vitriol in those blogs is just astounding. I mean, it just leaves you feeling like you've been dipped in slime. You know, the people get really angry and say really horrible things. That somehow it's become depersonalized. The very thing that we feel most personal about has become depersonalized. Well, that's an interesting thing. How did that happen? So what comes to mind when you think of equanimity? Now, there's this question of balance. Some people think that it implies passivity, you know, that you become impassive. You don't react to anything. I don't think that's it. I mean, passivity implies giving up, laying down. And equanimity has much more strength to it. It sort of sways and returns to the place it came from. It's very rooted. It isn't impassive at all. It isn't about not feeling things. It's something a little different than that. Equanimity is being completely in the present moment and accepting what's there. Doesn't mean that you don't ever try to change anything, but you take it in. You don't push it away. You take it in and you say, okay, I'm going to stay with this. What does that mean? How do we do that? So, in my yard, we have a view out from our yard. We live on the edge of Point Reyes National Seashore. And there was a big fire up there, 11, 12 years ago. And the place that we live had burned. And so there are these big Douglas fir trees there. And their lower branches are all gone because they were burnt away. But the tops of them have these big, bushy areas. And they're very tall trees. And this last winter, we had some gale force winds. And the winds were blowing through there. And we grabbed the tops of those trees. And they would bend like this. I mean, these are really tall trees. And they would bend over. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to break. And then they would pop back up. And they would bend, and they would pop back up. That's the kind of equanimity I'm talking about, the kind that really is solid. So the Buddha said, equanimity, he described a mind filled with equanimity as abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility, without ill will. That's a very spacious feeling, isn't it? Very spacious, unbounded. not like that contraction of argument and disagreement. And you know, it isn't that we don't have opinions. It's that we hold those opinions somewhat more lightly. We don't bludgeon people with our opinions. They're, after all, only thoughts, right? They're ephemeral. And yet we take these thoughts and we push them around and try to convince people that they have real heft, right? Somehow we have to hold it lightly. So as I was thinking about this, I thought about a friend of mine who is my model for equanimity. The guy is incredible. He's just a cool customer. He's a tall black man, yoga master. He stands very calmly in the room, and the thing that you notice about him is his attention. He's present. He is so totally present. And things happen. I've seen him under quite a bit of stress. And he goes, now this is happening. Oh, now this is happening. And it's not an act. You know, you meet some people who say, oh yeah, now this is happening. It's a totally different feeling. This guy is just there with it. Oh, now this is happening. He is so cool. And I've tried to figure out what it was about him that gave him that sense of equanimity. You know, he would have, things would come in and he'd say, didn't mean that it didn't affect him or that it didn't touch him. It definitely touched him. He just didn't fall over in the face of it. He didn't go running after it. He didn't go running away from it. He just said, oh. It's a quite remarkable thing. And the quality of attention was the thing that is most remarkable. He was right there with him. You're sitting in a place that's warm and right here. There's something about being right here and taking it all in that has to do with equanimity. And that's not necessarily intuitive, you know. It feels like if something is coming at you that is unpleasant, you know, the natural tendency is to sort of put up the barrier. But in fact, to be equanimous, you have to not put up the barrier. You have to let it just pass through you. It has to be right there with you. In the Pali language, which is the language of the Buddha, there are two different words that we use for equanimity. One of them is upekkha, which means to look over. It implies a large view, taking the larger view. So we can look over what's happening. The second word is tatramajjhakata, and that means to be in the midst of. So it's got more of that standing in the midst of. So there are these two different ideas that go into the word equanimity. One, the looking over, has to do with wisdom, where we gather things together and we see them. And by seeing the impermanence of life, for example, we can become less attached to the things that are there. You begin to see consequences. You know that conditions have consequences, that actions have consequences. So this wisdom then becomes part of what goes into your ability to withstand what comes at you, because you notice what happens and you take it in. In one of my cabinets at home, I have a piece of calligraphy. It's in the cabinet with my glasses, and it says, "This glass is already broken, so I enjoy it immensely." And you'd be amazed how often I have to take that out of the cabinet and look at it every time one of my favorite glasses gets broken. So this a week or so ago, my husband comes to me and he says, "Oh, so-and-so broke my cup, my frog cup." And I'm thinking, frog cup? What frog cup? What's he talking about? He says, "But I did it. I did just what you told me." He says, "I pulled out that piece of paper and it said, 'This cup is already broken, so I enjoy it immensely.'" He said, "After all, it has always only temporarily been unbroken. That's a small piece of equanimity. It's always only been temporarily unbroken. Now, this is really looking at change as it happens. Now, frankly, a frog cup is a pretty easy thing. What about if you lose a person, someone you love, to death, to divorce? You lose a job? How do we stay put for that? We don't have a piece of calligraphy that tells us that's okay. How about sudden fame? Sudden joy? Do we now decide that this is something that we own, that we have? You know, it's our right, we have this. You know, both things. Sorrow turns to joy, joy turns to sorrow. No one's exempt. We all get to experience all of these things. And all of them have the ability to move us off course, to send us reeling away. Now we're talking about standing in the middle of it, standing in the middle of sorrow, standing in the middle of joy. What are we going to do with that? Equanimity, then, is the quality that allows us to keep our hearts opened and balanced, steady, quiet, in the midst of all the changes. So, sometimes there's a list. You know, Buddhism has lots of lists. One of the lists that Buddhism has is the list of the 8 worldly winds. A lot of times what blows us off course when we're not feeling very equanimous are the result of these 8 worldly winds: praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. How often do we find ourselves on one side or the other of these matched pairs? And we're convinced we don't belong on that side of that matched pair, right? We lose our job. All of a sudden, we don't know who we are. We've always been successful. I don't know what to do with failure. Crash. Right? Or you become very used to praise. And somebody says to you, how could you have done that? The dislocation, the difference between the way you've always seen yourself and the way you're now being seen is too much. It's too great. And you find yourself just lost. By developing equanimity, we develop the ability to stay with that and not be so blown away by it, by one of these 8 winds. We learn that these conditions are temporary. They don't stay this way. They're not always this way. You know, that's kind of the worst thing. I was fired once, and I thought, oh, my God, I'll never live this down. It'll always be this way. My career is ruined. Everything about my life is ruined. Well, you know, it's kind of a cliche, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. We don't know always what these insults to us, what the jab is. And we control the amount of suffering by how we relate to whatever that insult is. So equanimity is the way that we lessen that suffering by not adding to it. So I'm sure you've all had the experience of being involved in an argument, and the argument starts escalating, and it's getting bigger and bigger, and you're holding more and more firmly to your point of view. And the next thing you know, you're advocating for something well beyond what you intended. You've gone way out to the extreme. And you're saying, wow, how did I get out on the end of this limb? And now there's no easy way back, right? I mean, you don't want to give up ground. You've been fighting so hard. And then what? What would happen if you just laughed? Well, that's an interesting idea. Might have some virtue. I'm going to read you something. I actually have been saving this particular reading from Rumi for years. and I finally found a place to use it. This is called Ali in Battle. Learn from Ali how to fight without your ego participating. God's lion did nothing that didn't originate from his deep center. Once in battle, he got the best of a certain knight and quickly drew his sword. The man, helpless on the ground, spat in Ali's face. Ali dropped his sword, relaxed, and helped the man to his feet. Why have you spared me? How has lightning contracted back into its cloud? Speak, my prince, so that my soul can begin to stir in me like an embryo. Ali was quiet and then finally answered, I am God's lion, not the lion of passion. The sun is my lord. I have no longing except for the one. When a wind of personal reaction comes, I do not go along with it. There are many winds full of anger and lust and greed. They move the rubbish around, but the solid mountain of our true nature stays where it's always been. There is nothing now except the divine qualities come through the opening into me. Your impudence was better than any reverence, because in this moment I am you and you are me. I give you this opened heart as God gives gifts. The poison of your spit has become the honey of friendship. So how does this strike you? Does it seem likely? Basically, Ali, when he was spit upon, realized that's what he was feeling toward the other person. And he said, oh my God, we're really not different. We're really the same. And suddenly he couldn't do it anymore. It becomes not so personal. We can stop. We really can just stop. We're in the middle of an argument. We're in the middle of anything that we're getting carried away by. And we can just stop. Enough. Now, I'm not going to tell you this is easy. But it is possible. It's possible to do. Another thing besides these eight winds that contribute to a lack of equanimity has to do with certain kinds of addictions. Addictions to visions of ourselves. This is the way I am. This is who I am. I've got to be this way. Everything that is reinforcing me is a place where we're going to get stuck. It becomes a blind spot for us. When I was in my early 20s, I had a friend say to me, you know, your problem is you're just histrionic. Histrionic? You know, I said, well, I did not like that. I thought he was totally wrong. I still think he was wrong, but I actually understand what he was pointing to. Because I had a tendency at that time to be extremely elated or deeply depressed. And the way I interpreted it to myself was, this is me living life to the fullest, at the extremes of emotion. Well, what I was really doing is spending a lot of time going up and down. And instead of becoming a deeply intense person, I was an intensely erratic person. But it took a lot of space and a lot of development for me to see that. And what was true is that I was really addicted to that energy change. I liked that energy change. And so I had developed in my life, you know, what we call hysteresis. You know, a lot of going back and forth over across the mid-range. It's sort of like the stock market, right? It goes up 200 points, it goes down 200 points, it goes up 400 points, it goes down 300 points. This is not stable. It may be going back and forth around some common place, but this is not stable. This isn't a place you can trust. This isn't a place you feel comfortable. What we need is to have that going up and down in a narrower range. It has nothing to do with intensity. It has only to do with how far off you allow yourself to be waved. So there's a Zen story about a man who was riding a horse, and he's going along, and the other guy says to him, "Where are you going?" And he says, "Ask the horse." Now, that's what it's like when we let ourselves get carried away by the emotion of the event, whatever it is. We're not in control of where we're going any longer. So what do we do about that? There are ways that we can improve our equanimity, work with our equanimity. So there are, in fact, 7 mental qualities that go into becoming a more equanimous person. One of them is virtue or integrity. If we're living our lives in a way that we can depend on ourselves, we work from a place of confidence, of competence. Right? If you do what you say you're going to do, then you know you can rely on yourself. I mean, it's kind of an odd thing, but in order to be equanimous, you have to know, you have to trust yourself. And one of the ways that you can trust yourself is to be a person of integrity. I'm the kind of person I want to be. You know, this is the kind of person I want to be. So we exercise right speech and right action. We don't engage in name calling. It's not right speech. Doesn't feel good. I don't want somebody calling me a name. So I'm not going to call you a name. All of these things can kind of add up. And then you're working from a place of strength. Oh yeah, I can believe in me. You use an I statement instead of a you statement. You are always upsetting me. No. You know, when you do that, I get so upset. Now it's me that's getting upset. It's not something you're doing to me. Well, these are things that we can work on that give us a feeling that we're in charge of what we're doing. Not that we're in control, but that we know what we're doing. The second one is a sense of assurance that comes from faith. I'm not talking about blind faith here. I'm talking about the faith that comes from experience, where you can believe in something because you've seen it work. Just as we learn something about our bodies by testing it, we can learn about ourselves as well. And that sense of assurance tells us, I can rely on me. So now I know that I can break a glass without it being the end of the world. Okay, that's a step. That's something I know. I know I can be equanimous in that situation. If I can expand my repertoire, then I can start being more equanimous in the larger places as well. The third one is a well-developed mind. This is a mind that is able to be calm and steady, that can hold still. This is a mind that comes from mindfulness and concentration, where we have strength in our mind. It isn't a totally undisciplined mind. This is important when we become really agitated about something and we're in conversation with someone. If we cannot control our thoughts, if we can't say, oh, there goes that wild thought, I don't have to own that thought, I don't have to be that thought, then we're not going to be able to control the way we are in the world. We're not going to come from that place of strength. The fourth is a sense of well-being. You know, just plain feeling good about yourself. Feeling good about your body, about your place in the world. It's the kind of well-being that comes from saying, I think I'm just going to go take a walk. I got to get out of here for a while. I've got to bring myself back down to where I feel more like myself. Maybe it's just having a cup of tea. This afternoon I was sitting with a woman who was very charming, but completely demented. She has a running story, and it doesn't matter what I say to her. She's telling the story, And I can say almost anything as long as I'm friendly, you know, my voice is friendly, then she's telling her story. And this is interesting for a while, and then it can get boring. And then I find myself saying, okay, she's losing my attention. I've got to get up for a while. I went outside, breathed a little air, looked at the sunshine, came back in. I was happy to see her again. But I had to go away. I had to remove myself and get myself back into balance. This is a sense of well-being. The fifth one is understanding or wisdom. And we've kind of talked around this quite a bit. There are several kinds of ways of wisdom that contribute to equanimity. One is to separate people's actions from themselves. Parents and children know all about this, right? I love you, but don't do that, right? Where you separate this person does not become evil because you disagree with them. Something that everybody in politics seems to have forgotten. We don't take words so personally. This tendency to personalize something is something that really gets us into trouble. There's a guy who is a schizophrenic. He's a real hallucinating guy. I mean, he lives in a world of hallucinations. And he's in the hospice, and at a shift change meeting, one of my colleagues said, you know, you really got to go talk to this guy. He really seems to like people around today, and he's engaging with people. It's a little hard to stay with him because, you know, he was asking for 20,000 cockroaches, but I really think that you ought to go see him. So I come bopping into his room. I smile at him. He smiles back at me. He says, are you here to sit with me? And I said, yeah. And I sat down in the chair, and he said, I would like some privacy, please. Whoa, I read that one all wrong. Now, it was possible for me to say, oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing. I never should have done this. Why didn't I notice? And begin to beat myself up. Or I can say, and because he's schizophrenic, I'll admit it's easier. This doesn't have anything to do with me. Now, it's harder when you're talking to your spouse and they say, you are always doing X, Y, and Z. And it has really to do with the fact that they woke up at 3 this morning and have been working on a report and they're really sick of it. It doesn't have anything to do with you. And you take it personally. I take it personally. What do you mean I always, right? And you're off and running and it's all out of balance. So separating the person from the event. Another is recognizing that people are responsible for their own decisions. This one's really useful when we get tied into wishing better things for other people and we want them to behave certain ways. And we kind of take on responsibility for them. But everybody's got to live their own life. And we're not responsible for the way other people make their choices. This allows us to be with other people's suffering without it bearing down on us. If my brother goes to prison, I'm going to feel bad about that. But I'm not responsible. Those were choices he made. Right? Another thing to do is to be aware when equanimity is absent. Okay, so I'll give you an example of this. A very good example, a recent example. I decided that I had two calendars, two electronic calendars on my desktop, and I was going to put one of them on the web in Google Calendars. So I set it up and I transferred the calendar to Google, and instead of taking the calendar I wanted, it took my personal calendar and put it on Google. And I said, oh, this will never do. So I erased it from Google. At that point, Google synced with my original calendar, wiping out my personal electronic calendar. Now, I don't know how many of you live by electronic calendars, but I do. This was a disaster for me. It was gone. And I thought, okay, I'm sure I have a backup. Well, it turns out, even though I religiously back up all my files, I haven't been backing up my Outlook file. Okay, fine. I go online. I'm trying to find, you know, there must be a way to retrieve this from Google. Well, it turns out there have been a few people who have been burned by this. And no, you can't retrieve it. It's gone. My calendar is gone. It's okay. I have another thing. I have my PDA. I'm going to transfer my calendar from my PDA to Outlook. I set it up. I push sync. And Outlook overwrites my PDA. And it's gone. At this point, I screamed. And then I said, okay, the calendar's gone. I was not equanimous about my calendar being gone. But, you know, the truth was, it didn't take that long to get over it. It took me about half an hour to get over it. And then all of a sudden, it was kind of nice. I had a totally empty calendar. Take a deep breath, try to recreate the calendar. But it was possible for me to be upset about that for a really long time. There was a time in my life when I would have been upset about that for a really long time. And I guess the point of that is to sort of put everything into perspective. We are not enlightened beings. We're human beings. We're not perfect. We're going to get bent. The question is, how far are we going to bend before we come back? So there are two more. There's insight, a deep seeing into the nature of things. Once we realize that everything is impermanent, we take a deep breath and the electronic calendar goes away. And say, ah, I get to live with impermanence. Here's a great lesson. No, I'm not going to tell you that. I was upset. But hey, so far I haven't missed anything. We'll see. Of course, I'm only a week into it. The other thing to keep in mind is that what we're really talking about is letting go of things. And the deeper the letting go, the deeper the freedom. Now, it's one thing to let go of a broken glass. It's another thing to let go of your need to be right. But can be just as freeing, which is the last issue. Freedom arrives when we begin to let go of all of our reactive tendencies. We just say, ah, okay, I'm going to let go of that. So I was in a discussion with my husband the other day, and we were becoming entrenched in our respective positions. And I didn't want him to tell me I was right. I didn't need him to tell me I was right. All I wanted him to tell me was that he saw my point of view. I'm getting more and more agitated. He is not going to see my point of view. I don't need to be told I'm right. Pretty soon I realized I also didn't need him to say, I see. And as soon as I let go of my need for him to say, I see, it was all gone. All that unpleasantness went away. Wow, that was such an easy thing to do. It didn't change anything that we were doing. I just had to let go of my need to hear those two words, I see. Wow. Talk about a strange thing to become attached to. But it has to do with meing, selfing. You know, I got to have this thing from him. Now, when I say we were free from that, I don't mean that all the ill will immediately went away. It took a while for that to dissipate because you get that charge built up. You know, it's like rubbing a piece of cloth and walking across a nylon rug and touching the doorknob, right? You've got to discharge some of that. And sometimes it takes a little time for that to happen. It takes time for that emotion to shift. But when we pay attention to the whole truth of the moment, just pay attention. Then it becomes a lot easier to understand it. It becomes a lot easier to kind of let it go. When you can really see what's going, then you can kind of let it go and say, all right. It's the practice of accepting everything that is producing equanimity. Ah, this is what's happening now. Oh, this is what's happening now. Uh-huh. Equanimity does not limit our ability to feel. We still feel it all. It just says, okay, I feel this. I'm not becoming this. I don't have to lay down in the face of it. Equanimity is about having resilience. That thing that causes us to pop back up. Do you ever see those toys, you know, those blow-up toys that are weighted at the bottom? And you push it over and it pops back up, and you push it over and it pops back up. Well, that's kind of what equanimity is like. You push it over and you pop back up. Say, okay, I'm back. Joan Halifax said something about equanimity that I really love. Let's see if I can find it here. Ah. Equanimity is the capacity to be in touch with suffering and at the same time not be swept away. It is the strong back that supports the soft front of compassion. Equanimity is the strong back that supports the soft front of compassion. It's a really nice way to put it. So there are two forms of equanimity, the one that has to do with the power of observation, the looking over, and the one that comes from inner balance. And these two come together in mindfulness, being aware of what's going on right now in front of us. So one of the things I was thinking about is one of the primary Buddhist symbols, which is a lotus flower. So the lotus is seen as a symbol of enlightenment. So it has its roots down in the mud, and the stem comes up through the water and pushes its way out, and the flower blooms on top. So we're rooted in mud, the samsara of rebirth. We rise up through our mindfulness into enlightenment. So this is kind of a central image of Buddhism. So it turns out one of the characteristics of a lotus is that it repels water. And the leaves are kind of self-cleaning. They're waxy leaves. And they sit on top of the water. And they repel the water. So it turns out in 1987, there was a German scientist who took electron micrographs of lotus leaves. And what he found was that they had a number of little microstructures, nanostructures, that controlled the angle of the surface to the water. And it would cause the water to bead up and pick up dirt. These little beads would pick up dirt and roll off the flower, sort of like mercury. I don't know if any of you are familiar with mercury, broken a thermometer. Mercury will roll around on the floor, and it'll bead up in little balls, and it'll gather up dirt to it. Well, this is what happens on a lotus leaf. It's these angles, these micro angles on the surface of the leaf. So equanimity is a lot like that. Where we have the place where we can kind of manage our direction to these attacks, these insults that come toward us. And the spray comes at us, beads up, and it takes away all that dirt and ill will and rolls off. I want to leave you the poem by Jane Hirschfeld called Optimism. More and more, I have come to admire resilience. Not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree. Finding the light newly blocked on one side, it turns in another. A blind intelligence, true, that out of such persistence arose turtles, rivers, mitochondria, figs, all this resinous, unretractable earth. More and more I have come to admire resilience, not the simple resistance of a pillow whose foam returns over and over to the same shape, but the sinuous tenacity of a tree. I wish you the sinuous tenacity of a tree. Thank you. So are there any questions? Does any of this make sense? Is it all wishful thinking?
Thank you for sharing. I'm just curious what your personal favorites are in terms of strategies to, as far as when attacks come in. I've been advised about, you know, getting into your body, you know, when you get that reaction, to just get grounded and to really just check in and see what's going on with your body. So I'm curious, I imagine that would be one. I mean, it's been helpful for me. Any other suggestions or techniques for...
Well, I think checking in with your body is really a good strategy. What I notice, I'll give you an example. One of the things that about myself that I know upsets people is when I'm thinking about something, I wrinkle my brow. It's a habit, a lifetime habit. And people assume that it means that I'm unhappy and that I don't like something. And that I'm frowning at them. Well, unfortunately, when I'm really thinking about something, which is when that brow is furrowed, I'm not particularly thinking about my body. And so it's a habit that I'm having a really hard time breaking, this, you know, screwing up my forehead part. And it's only if I am in the midst of something that I'm trying to think about and I decide I need more information, the information that comes from my body, that I notice it. But that's a really good signal that there's something that requires my attention, that I'm losing it. Usually for me, I'll start noticing the energy in my body changing. I'm very sensitive to the energy flow in my body. And so that's what I'm noticing. Then I know I'm getting out of whack, right? I'm getting off kilter somehow when that energy starts going up. And the first thing I do is ask myself if I've had caffeine. You know, I do a little chemical check. And then I say, oops, I'm getting out of balance here. And then I ask what's going on. So it's kind of a combination of noticing that change in my body and asking the question. So that I can stop and ask myself that question, whatever it is, what's happening? And then I can sometimes stop. So for example, I was in a political discussion with a neighbor who was trying really hard to convert me to his point of view. And he said, you know, I'm really worried that this is going to cost us our friendship. And I said, well, not on my side. And he said, oh, good. You know? So sometimes it's stepping back from the place where you are. When you find yourself really engaged, just temporarily disengage and see what happens. See where it is. It's that principle of finding yourself way out on a limb and then laughing. Because it breaks that rush in some direction. So I'd say that's my favorite strategy. Whoops, what's happening?
So one thing I was thinking about when you asked the question, when you were mentioning the tree or something like a toy popping down and coming back up, I asked myself if anyone's ever defined the degrees of equanimity.
Degrees.
How many, like, you know, how many times do you fall down and then come back up? Sometimes it's 3, sometimes it's 100, sometimes it's 1,000. But
I think what I'm learning over time, and I haven't found the answer to this yet, is that equanimity is equanimity. There is no degree. You may do it on the first time, one time. You may do it on the 100th time, another time. For me, the challenge is always, if I do it on the 100th time, how do I still see that it's equanimity and that there aren't degrees of it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think so much about degrees of equanimity either. I was reading something yesterday or today about the Dalai Lama, who, as you know, is under some pressure right now because of riots in Tibet. And so I went back and looked at his book on anger. And in that book, he said, you know, people seem to think that I'm a static individual, that I've become, you know, that I'm this thing. And he said, what I notice is over my life, I've changed a lot. Now, he says, I was chosen to start taking lessons as a monk as a very small child. But I was 16 before I started taking any of it seriously. And even then, I didn't know what I was doing. And he said, I've been at this another few years after that, and I'm still learning. And I'm still learning, and I'm not there. And I think that's where we all are. You know, that what we're talking about is maybe rather than degrees, I like to think of how long do I stay out there on the edge before I come back. You know, how soon do I come back to my real self? It's not how many times do I fall down. How often do I come back to my real self? Yeah. I think the idea of degrees is not useful because we're all engaged in practice, right? And I like my little piece of calligraphy with my glass because it is practice for me. And it's reassuring to me. And I know that I don't have to get upset. I know I can let go of my point of view. I know I can let go of my position. I know I can let go of needing to hear certain words. And every time I learn that, I'm stronger. And that ability to remain centered on that broad expanse of equanimity is greater. I mean, the thing about that toy that falls over and pops back, right? It's kind of immediate and it kind of snaps up. That's not really my experience of equanimity, you know. If I hold a strand of my hair out, you know, here it is, it's way out here, it's not where it belongs, it's out of equilibrium. I let it go. It doesn't snap back to my head. It falls down. It falls with the natural flow of what hair does. And that's what our life is like. You know, we go, there's a natural flow that occurs. What we want is to increase the range over which that occurs. I'm remembering again my friend who has such great equanimity and what a joy it is to stand next to him and how safe I feel standing next to him because he's so solid. He's not going to... It isn't that he never stumbles. It's that he's going to say, oh, now this is happening. Oh, now this is happening. Well, everything is not life or death with him. There's a maturity, a spiritual maturity that allows him to take it in and say, okay, this is what's happening now. And that's what I aspire to. May you all the lotus blossoms. Thank you.